Blog Talk Radio.
And Dirty is back on the air. This morning, we're going to talk about the Israel-Palestine conflict that has been raging in its most recent iteration for about 2-3 months. People have been bothering me, asking me to talk about this because they know I probably have a really interesting view on this conflict. So that's what we're going to talk about today. First of all, let's do a little housekeeping. If you're listening this morning live, you know you can call in and drop your 2 cents. And if you want to do that, you can do that at the following number, area code 563-999. 3030. If you want to call in and join into the conversation, you can call in at area code 563-999-3030. So let's get at it, folks. We know that if we have a trouble spot anywhere in the world that is just constantly has the eyes of the world upon it, it would be the Middle East. And the focus of the conflict in the Middle East has always been Israel, at least in modern times. Now, we know throughout history this is a crossroads from Europe, Africa, and Asia. So every major power that has existed in the old world and the new has gone through there in some point of fashion. In our modern world, the largest oil reserves in the world surround this region, whether it's the Caucasus, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's the fields of Iraq and Iran. Those are some of the, you know, most well-known and accessible oil reserves in the world right now. And, you know, most of the other oil reserves we have are in modern nations like Russia, here in the United States, Venezuela, off the coast of West Africa, where it's not in such a strategic position to where we decide to fight over. But the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not rooted in oil. There are several things that cause this conflict to continue to fester and from time to time blow up, and on several occasions have taken us to the brink of all-out war. And today that's what we're going to talk about. Now, a lot of people want to sit here and go, okay, it's biblical. Some people say it's not. And it's actually both. The conflict is very much steeped in religion. you got to understand that three of the world's major religions are all focused on the city of Jerusalem. If you are a Christian, Muslim, or Jew, Jerusalem is a focal point for all of our faith traditions. We understand if you are a member of one of those three religions, that area is where the birthplace of the genealogies come from. If you're Muslim, you can trace Muhammad back to Ishmael. If you're a Jew, you trace everything back to Jacob and Abraham. All of us trace back to Abraham, because even Jesus is from the house of David. So well, you got three major religions, all who share common roots, who have found themselves opposed to each other at different points in history. And you share a city that is either the center or a major focal point to your faith. That's going to be a fight. And you add on top of that the Israelis, who have the Jewish state, biblically see themselves as God's chosen people, and that prophecy has foretold that they will return one day and build a modern Israeli kingdom or Israeli state, then you see that element. Then you see the global politics that play into this. Now, let's talk about the Israeli claim to Israel first. If you are an adherent to Judaism or Christianity, we know in the Old Testament that the Jewish people, the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, were both conquered by the Babylonians in the around 300-400 BC. And they were sent into exile. And you see in the prophecies of Nehemiah and Isaiah and all of the books of the prophets, you see where God of Israel, the same God that is the Christian God, and also, let's be understanding, also he's the Muslim God. He's also Allah. Y'all might not like that idea, but that's what it is. It's constantly reminding them and telling them, look, you're my chosen people, but you kind of done got out of whack with me. But when you get straight again, and all of those people who done got out of whack with me done died, then I'll bring y'all back. And so they come back just in time for the rise of the Roman Empire. So then you get Rome conquers Judea. That's what it was called at the time, was Judea. And then they changed the name to Palestine. And, you know, there were political reasons behind that. You're not going to give them a name that kind of, you're not going to continue the province to have a name that lends them to having a kingdom when you got this group of people who are really kind of hyped up on having their own thing and they like fighting about it. So you have them returning to Israel, rebuilding their temple, which is the focal point of everything Judaism, is the temple. Even today, the Western Wall of the last temple is a very holy space. is a point of contention in the city of Israel, because on top of it, you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the place where Muhammad ascended into heaven from on top of the rock that's there. He ascended into heaven from there. And it's also believed that Jesus also ascended to heaven from that same spot. So, yeah, y'all get how this gets complicated. Well, right after the time of Jesus Christ, there was another Jewish rebellion against Roman rule. And, you know, if you've ever been to Israel, you know about the siege at Masada. You know about the siege at Jerusalem. And the Romans destroyed the temple. And this was the last time that the Jewish temple stood. They burnt that joker down, and all that was left was the Western Wall. And again, about the same time, there was another I would want to say mass immigration of the Jewish people across the region, which is the basis of the modern Jewish diaspora. Now, we also know that during the time period of the Roman Empire and the fall of the Roman Empire and the rise of the Holy Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, we know that the Jewish people were spread all across the region and suffered persecution at the hands of people around them, particularly because, you know, there's always been this thing about, you know, the Jewish people and the wealth that they carried and their influence over the banking system and this and other that we still deal with today, which is neither here nor there, but it caused their persecution because we have, again, there's this thing about Europeans being jealous of people who they think are in a better position than they are. And, you know, this is something that we really got this is a very big focal point of Jewish persecution. And you can also link it to persecution of other minorities that have come in contact with members of the white race. So, anyway, I'm reading comments on different things as they come up on Facebook. But we kind of let that slide from my mind over as a global thought. The nation of Israel kind of slid from everybody's memory as we went through the Dark Ages and the Renaissance and the period of enlightenment. You know, those things kind of floated away. In the late 19th century, the idea of Zionism, the Zionist movement, comes onto the world scene, primarily European at the time, but having some support out of American Jewish society, propping up in Europe basically because of the persecution of Jews in Europe that had been persistent since the fall of the Roman Empire. So you're talking about thousands of years of persecution taking place. You know, being forced out of kingdoms. You had the Spanish Inquisition, which forced hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Jews to be forced into converting to Catholicism. You have early attempts at what I would call very similar to the Holocaust, where if you didn't convert, that people were killing the Jews of Europe. And so just like every other persecuted group in Europe, you know, when the Americas opened up, Jewish people followed and, again, are a very major part of American society and have influenced America greatly. in many positive ways. It is part of the great melting pot that is America. Well, at the same time, across the ocean, you have the decline of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was the successor state to the Byzantine Empire or the Eastern Roman Empire. And had major control over the Middle East and the Near East and parts of Eastern Europe since around between the 1100s to the 1300s, after the fall of fall of Constantinople, which is modern day Istanbul. Now, during this time, you know how the Europeans were constantly fighting wars back and forth. You always had the French. You know, in the particularly this time, the French and the English, you know, against the Holy Roman Empire, which is just in this particular the late 19th century had reformed into the German Empire. You know, after Bismarck and Wilhelm the First. Let me say that correctly. It's not William. It's Wilhelm the First. You know, let me not act like I don't speak German. So I'm not going to call him William. He's Wilhelm. Formation of the German Empire. And then you also had Russia, which was attempting to exert itself as a global power. And the Ottoman Empire kind of put a thorn in all of these great European powers' side because, one, they had territory in Eastern Europe, which challenged the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which that was a whole situation in itself because of them being a, quote-unquote, Germanic nation and the whole idea of there being a German Empire, there being Austria. And the Russians wanting warm water access to trading and everywhere else. And this goes into a whole nother conflict with probably a whole nother show at some point, understanding why Russia wants the Crimea so bad. But this all plays into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict because everybody wants the Ottomans gone. They are a major empire, a major world power that is not Christian, with a foothold in Europe. And as we go into the 20th century, there's been several wars that have been fought over the Bosphorus Straits, and everybody wanted control of the area, particularly for the British. It was very important because the British had just gotten, in the late 19th century, made Egypt into a protectorate and built the Suez Canal. So that was a very strategic point for them to be able to stay in control of. And they had taken this from the Ottomans. And they really wanted to continue to stick it to the Ottomans. So this, we fast forward into World War One. The Ottoman Empire is a part of the German sphere of influence. So you have Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire fighting against the Russians, the British, and the French, and the Americans. Which the Americans didn't play a whole lot play a large role in the Eastern theaters of the First World War. You know, we were primarily in France fighting, and so we didn't play a large part in that. But this is, many of you know the story of Lawrence of Arabia. So you had the Arabians who wanted independence. So you had King Faisal and all of them of the family Saud, which this is where you get the name Saudi Arabia from, because it's from one particular Arab family, the Saud family, making deals with the British to fight the Ottomans, to get the Ottomans to allow them to have independence. So you have the foreign minister who is Balfour, for the British foreign ministry. Let me make sure, because I got to look at my notes. He was a former prime minister of Great Britain. You know, making deals with folk. And so he, in 1917, it is very interesting because you kind of match this with kind of like the Emancipation Proclamation here in the United States. You really want to kind of stick it to somebody. So you start, you know, making deals with minorities that are, you know, kind of on your side and different causes. So they needed support. And there was a documentary that I was watching in process of doing the research for this that says that one of the reasons he went for the Jewish people is because he needed America to jump into the war. And there was a miscalculation that the only way that the Americans would join the war would be if they knew that the banks would back them. And so he kind of being a little racist and anti-Semitic right here by saying, if we get the Jewish bankers in America backing this, along with the, because it was kind of the same thing, we're believing that the Jewish bankers of Europe would get behind this and help support, you know, the British, the British aspiration of taking down the Ottoman Empire. So him and Lord Rothschild, actually Balfour was doing the because I'm reading over my notes, was the foreign secretary in 1917 for the British Empire. Wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild, who was the leader of the British Jewish community, to talk to the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Northern and Ireland. And everybody was like, okay, this is a great thing, you know. We get their support, which would then in turn help us get the American support, and we promised the Jewish people a homeland in Palestine, and we put another thorn in the side of the Ottomans. Well, we know that British foreign policy in the late 1900s, the late 19th century, and the early 20th century was really flawed and really steeped in white supremacy, because the British believed that, hey, if we run things would be in better order. You know, we can control how the world develops, and because we're the British Empire and the sun doesn't set on the British Empire type deal. Yeah, that kind of crazy. So and this was really needed. He really needed American support at this time, because we all know that what happens in Russia in 1917. We got the Bolshevik Revolution and Russians dropping out of the war, therefore letting Germany go, hey, we now can take all of our troops from worrying with the Russians, and we can now put them on the Western Front. This probably kept the war going on for that additional year. If the Russians hadn't dropped out, we probably could have ended the war in 1917, way before the Americans were able to put, you know, get troops here. Now, the term national home we don't think was actually they were intending on forming a state of Israel or a Jewish state, but the Zionists looked at it that way. And but you also had the declaration calling for the safeguarding of the rights of the Palestinian Arabs, who were the majority of the population. And there were a lot of shady deals made during the First World War, in which the British made a lot of promises to a lot of people that they did not plan on keeping. And so after World War One was over, you have the British and the French, who had a whole nother side deal going on to carve up the Ottoman Empire. So as we go back and the fall of the Ottoman Empire takes place, that the main part, which, you know, the Ottoman Empire were, when the leaders of the Ottoman Empire were not Arabs, they were Turks. So you had the Turkish people of the Ottoman Empire that survived, formed the modern nation of Turkey. Then you have Britain and France carve up the Transjordan area, and the areas that were, you would consider ancient Babylon. You have them in Syria. So there's a French mandate that is put in place in Syria and Lebanon. There's a British mandate formed out of Palestine, Jordan, and Iraq. Saudi Arabia gains independence in 1921. Iran is Persia. And then you have Egypt, which had been taken from the Ottomans early on, which is still a British possession, all the way down to the Sudan and whatnot. You got the Anglo-Egyptian mandate of Sudan. Now, the Palestinians had been promised a state also, but they didn't get it because of the British just being fuckboys, basically. And so we get into the interwar period where you get a few Jewish members of the Zionist movement who do move toward Palestine. And they set up, you know, the communes and whatnot after the war, and they are still, the Zionist movement is still going forth talking about forming a Jewish state and this, that, and the other, but it kind of gets sidelined during the interwar period until we have World War II. And we know what happens during World War II. We have the Germans starting with, you know, the stripping of Jews of their citizenship and their property. And after Germany starts, you know, extending its footprint into Austria after the Auschwitz, and you have the taking over of Czechoslovakia, and then you have the actual war starting in 1939, in which in every nation that the Germans take occupation into, you see the rounding up of Jews and sent to the concentration camps that become the genocide that we know as of today as the Holocaust. Many Jewish people attempted to escape Germany during the war. And many were stopped, and they ended up becoming prisoners in concentration camps and dying and whatnot. So after the defeat of Germany and everybody finding out what Hitler really had going on, but as the final solution, a lot of people, and they again started talking about the national homeland in Palestine. And during this time period, you, right after the war, you have a lot of lobbying going on, and true enough, everybody's there. Everybody's kind of in agreement that this needs to happen. But how is it going to happen? Because you have, we just can't move all these people into this country. There are, there's a whole population there. You know, you just can't go in there and say, oh, we're going to put them in there, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. But the British are kind of like, yeah, we kind of need to let this, we kind of need to do something, you know, because this is their territory, and they kind of set this situation up. And, you know, the Jewish people of the area had fought alongside the Allies because this was an area that thought that was heavily bombed, you know, because again, this is a crossroads. Everybody wants to get, you know, control of this region because it's access to oil. So there was a lot of fighting that took place in that area. And the British formed the Jewish Brigade in 1944 and had supplied them with arms. And knowing that that was going to, and again, just like everybody else after the Second World War, most colonial possessions wanted independence. So at this point in time, you got the Palestinians saying, look, we want independence from Britain. And you got the Jews telling Britain, you promised to give us a homeland in the Balfour Declaration that you never gave. And so you have the brand new United Nations coming up with the partition plan for Palestine, which is known as Resolution 181. Which is probably one of the most important resolutions in the early days of the United Nations that recommended the creation of an independent Arab and Jewish state and Jerusalem being an international open city. Now let's talk about that for a moment there, because we're getting into this as we get into the whole why we still dealing with this crap today stuff. So Jerusalem, under the plan of Resolution 181 and subsequently Resolution 194, which we will get into it, was supposed to be corpus separatum, which is Latin for a separate body. Yeah, I like how I did that, the corpus separatum. Yeah, I like Latin is cool. Latin is cool. You need to study that. Latin is cool. Not just because you want to be lawyers, but you get a better understanding of
a lot of our modern language and whatnot when you learn, when you start trying to play around with that. But you had them want to set Jerusalem aside as a separate city. And the concept was that Jerusalem would be kind of like the Vatican. You know, it would be a protected place that would be defended by the United Nations. And once upon a time, the French had a protectorate over Jerusalem and over the Holy See. And everybody kind of knew that you just couldn't get a city to either side, because if you did, it would cause a problem, you know. And the United Nations was kind of like, hey, there needs to be special places around the world that, because this wasn't the only place that they thought about having this international city, open city, because they realized that around the world there were these problems. But the idea of this open international city that the Jews didn't take very, the Jewish people didn't take very kindly to, because the original plan had it be an open city under Arab sovereignty, but then they moved it, and then because the Jews they rejected the plan and supported a limited international situation in which they would be controlling the city, but except for the holy site. Kind of breaking it down, because Jerusalem don't kind of be like the papal states. And so then they start breaking it down, willing it down. So now the Vatican, just like Vatican City, there's nothing but the area around St. Peter's Basilica and all of the things that are on that site, plus a couple of little places outside the city that are owned by the Holy Roman Catholic Church. But that plan failed. And when you had, in 1948, the British just kind of gave up. The British just kind of gave up. Because there were terrorist attacks going on between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They were bombing each other, attacking each other, very similar in the ways that they do today. And the Jews said, okay, we got a plan. We accept it. And they, on, what's the date here? What's the date? Read through the notes. Where is this at? Where are my notes on that? So on May 14th, which passed just a couple of weeks ago, 1948, which was the nation of Israel, the state of Israel claimed to be a Jewish state. And it turned into immediately the 1948 Arab-Israeli war, in which Israel, the Arabs were attempting to crush the infant state of Israel, and Israel sought to consolidate its power over the parts that it's supposed to have. And if you look at a map of the partition, the original partition was a little was a lot smaller than what we ended up with in the 1949 borders. You didn't, you know, if you look at that map, there were a lot of northern Israel wasn't a part of Israel. They had the coast. They got Haifa, Tel Aviv. Jerusalem sat in the middle of the West Bank, which was Palestinian. They got most of what we consider Judea, which would have been the southern part that goes down to the Red Sea. Gaza and some of the area that bordered Israel. I mean, Jordan bordered Egypt, was a part of Palestine. But after the Six-Day War, you had new borders drawn up because Israel had taken everything, most of Palestinian territory from Gaza. They had taken most of the northern territory that bordered Lebanon. Okay, and those borders, the armistice border of 1949 stayed in place until you had the Six-Day War in 1967. Now, the Six-Day War puts us into a period in which we've seen what most of the people in my generation saw as modern borders of Israel. During the Six-Day War, which was started Let's go back. Because we kind of got to understand how we get to where we are. Relations between Israel and its neighbors was not cool after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, and even after you had the borders kind of settled. You had in 1956 Israel invaded Egypt and took the way of its way to Sinai Peninsula. For most of us that, and that included taking Gaza away, most of that area is something that we saw in 1956, because there was also around the same time that you had the French and the British attempt to take the Sinai Peninsula away from Egypt, which almost sparked the United States getting involved and possibly fighting the French and the British over the over the Suez Canal. And you see how complicated this is, because you got other groups that are here. Now, eventually, the Israelis withdrew but didn't give up the territory that was in the Sinai Peninsula, which that area was occupied by UNEF, the United Nations Emergency Force. Which that group, you know, there were members of the American military who served in those peacekeeping operations, Blue Helmet. And it was really a tense period because the Israelis didn't care. The Israelis didn't care if they fought the Americans. The Israelis didn't care if they fought the British. The Israelis didn't care if they fought the French. They didn't care who they fought. They knew that this was their land and they wanted it to be, and they were prepared to defend it, understandably, you got a group of people who, a lot of them by this point in time, were former European Jews who had just suffered through the Holocaust and were bound and determined that it wasn't going to happen again. If you understand Israeli military culture, you join the Israeli military and when you join the Israeli military, one of the last passages, similar to the Marines crucible and, you know, the gauntlet, the Israeli military has this run that they do up Mount Masada. And once you get to the top of the mountain, they go Masada, Masada, never again, Masada, Masada, never again. And this links back to the siege back in AD 70 that the Romans had done to them. And again, this is also attached to the Holocaust. The Israeli people culturally will not allow themselves to be put in a position to where they would be put near being they would be put in a position to being wiped out of. They are not going to put themselves in a position to where somebody could possibly conquer them and affect another genocide. That is top strategic priority. Never again will they allow themselves to be put in a position to be wiped out. So you have to understand that idea that they are not planning on dying for us or nobody else ever again. It's not happening. They are not, not going to allow themselves to be taken. But after the Six-Day War, the Israelis take the West Bank. They take Gaza. And they take parts of Jerusalem. And as a part of that, they draw what they call the there was a demarcation line. And they also captured the rest of the Sinai Peninsula, which we now, most of the territories that they still hold now that are part of the Palestinian, we call the occupied territory. And the green line is kind of the negotiating point that most people want to see as the basis of where the withdrawal takes place to the formation of an actual Palestinian state, which we have a Palestinian state in existence now, but that's a whole situation. But so as we come into this comes into our modern situation. So in 1979, the great president, Jimmy Carter, brokers a peace deal between Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel, Prime Minister of Israel. They signed the Camp David Accords, and Israel agreed to give the Sinai Peninsula back to Egypt. And it is one of the greatest, this is considered one of the greatest foreign policy coups of Jimmy Carter's administration. This is the high point of the Carter administration. Because a couple of months later, we have the whole little thing that happened in Tehran with the seizing of the American embassy. Now, at this point, we say, here enters America. And America has had a very iffy relationship with the nation of Israel, with the state of Israel, because we had the Pablo incident in 64, in which the Israelis attacked a United States naval ship. And Americans died and were captured. And one of the few situations that I can think of in American history that we allowed somebody to slide. We let them slide. That was a point of contention in the 60s, that we let the Israelis slide. But that kind of went into the background of the American foreign policy, that the Israelis actually attacked us and we let them slide. Usually if you attack one, I should. This is not maybe a couple of years after, either before or after the Tolkien incident, the Gulf of Tolkien incident. Similar situation. And we went to war in Vietnam, but we didn't go to war in Israel. But we're getting into that. We're getting into the juicy part of that. So, coming back to the Camp David Accords, this is us trying to say, hey, we got to get Israel kind of in a place where they can start. So this was the first major ally, the first major Arab nation that says, okay, we're going to have peace with the Israelis. And this is going to be a brave new world. But I, in my opinion, would say this was the catalyst that started what we know as terrorism in the Middle East, particularly when it comes to people attacking America. Because the reaction in the Arab world to the 1979 peace treaty led to what we would consider terrorist organizations was the PLO under Yasser Arafat. Then you had Islamic Jihad pop its head up. And one of their first major operations was the assassination on October 6th, 1981, of Anwar Sadat. Egypt was kicked out of the Arab League for 10 years based on this. So you start at this point, you start the attacks on pro-Israeli nations, people who supported Israel, and any target, because the PLO, which was founded in 1964, really becomes a major terrorist organization around this time. And their point was to liberate Palestine through the armed struggle. And the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, is the precursor to the Palestinian Authority. They still exist today. They're one of the major parties of the Palestine Liberation Organization. they form up less than half of the PLC, which is the Palestinian Legislative Council. Now, the question has been with PLO, has been the struggle between secularism and adherence to Islam. Because the PLO, for a long time, was seen in the United States as a proxy for the Soviet Union in the Middle East, particularly that they were getting support and arms from the surrounding Arab nations who were primarily armed with Soviet equipment. The only major Arab nation that I think did not have a large amount of Soviet equipment early on was Syria, because they bought most of their stuff from the French. The Lebanese and the Syrians had a lot of French weaponry until maybe the late 80s, when they started buying Soviet inventory, and then after the fall of the Soviet Union, they acquired a lot of former Russian equipment. The Egyptians, until that point, had always bought a lot from the Soviet Union, but because of the 1979 peace treaty, opened up defense contracts with the United States. And we were trading, again, the United States in the military-industrial complex was trading with a lot of different Arab nations who fell under our sphere. Egypt was buying American weaponry, because Egypt has F-16s and stuff of that nature. The Saudis were buying F-15s, F-16s. You had Iran up until the Islamic Revolution were buying F-4s and even F-14s. Interesting tidbit. Iran is the only nation outside of the United States that ever flew the famous F-14 Tomcat, which was the primary fighter interceptor of the United States Navy for almost 30, 40 years. This is a very high-tech, maybe third, fourth generation fighter. And the Iranians still fly this joke of the day. They don't fly as much, but when they do, you watch out for them. The only thing I think is that they never gave them the Phoenix missile, which was the long-range missile that could hit something from 100 miles away, and that's a big thing for a fighter jet. They didn't hit another fighter jet 100 miles away. But this is where you start seeing a lot of military aid going into the area because of the rise of terrorism. You see the PLO attacking the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1982, which then had the United States put a whole naval task force off the coast of the coast of Lebanon for years. Then you see the increased presence of the United States in the Middle East after the hostage crisis is over, and the increased tensions between Iran and the United States. And it is basically for two reasons that the Iranians have tension with the United States. One, the Islamic Revolution went to go for the embassy because we brought the Shah here when they wanted the Shah on trial in Iran, and because of our support for Israel. You just one of the reasons why Muammar Gaddafi, because of the, you know, wanting Palestine to be free, supported the PLO, Islamic Jihad, and what would then become Hezbollah, which was supported by the Iranians in Lebanon. Then you had the 82 war with Israel, in which you've seen Israel actually go into Lebanon which was one of the reasons there were American peacekeepers in Lebanon to begin with, was because after this war. So now you got all this military supplies going in. You got the Middle East becoming a proxy fight between the Soviets, the Soviet bloc, the Warsaw Pact, and NATO. You have this, you have the Zionist idea realized in a state of Israel. You have the Palestinians feeling like they've been slighted and shit upon by everybody in the world because everybody wants to negotiate with the Israelis. And nobody wants to negotiate with them, you know, because to this day, it still has not, there's really not a Palestinian, the Palestinian state does not have the same clout. As the state of Israel. You got, and then there's other little things that's taking place during this time period where you got the Israelis going on, that they're hunting Nazis, you know, snatching folks up in Germany. You got them snatching folks up all over the world. You got reprisal attacks. You got the Israelis developing a nuclear weapon. Now, this is a big thing because, you know, the non-proliferation treaty is a really, you know, this is the reason why you see us attacking different places, why we want to bomb Iran. But we never went as far with the Israelis because of 63, and this kind of deals with why we had the Pablo incident. It's because that was a spy ship and we were trying to see, hey, what the Israelis are doing with this nuclear program. This is part of the reason why the Israelis wanted to sign out to Nelson, because this is where they tested their weapons in that southern desert, near the Sinai Peninsula. The Israelis have had nuclear weapons. The Israelis have the technology. If they do not presently have active nuclear weapons, they have the ability to assemble them quite quickly, which if you know anything about international politics, if your nation has nuclear weapons and has tested one, the United States ain't going to do nothing but talk to you. Okay? The United States is going to do nothing but talk to you if you have a nuclear weapon. You do not have to worry about the United States performing any type of military operation overtly against your territory if you have a nuclear weapon. This is why it took us so long to find Osama bin Laden, because Pakistan is a nuclear armed nation. This is why you don't see us fooling around in Indian politics, because India has a nuclear weapon. This is what took us so long to deal with South Africa, because South Africa had nuclear weapons. This is why we talk a whole bunch of junk but don't do a whole bunch of nothing with North Korea, because North Korea has nuclear weapons. This is why we're friendly with the French, the British, and the Russians, because they all have nuclear weapons. So, and this is why Iran and everybody else wants nuclear. This is why we don't fool with the Chinese, because they have nuclear weapons. If you want to be seen as an equal in the world and have nobody, and don't want to have the United States fooling around in your backyard, you build a nuclear weapon. Because that puts you on par. Even if you got one, you can take out the one tactical nuclear device, can put the United States military in its place real quick. Because Nobody wants to get the threat of using one, because that puts us in a situation we have to retaliate. And if we retaliate with nuclear weapons, then that's not good. A nuclear exchange is not good. So you see all of this fervor taking place in the early 80s. Okay? You got the PLO, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, everybody like, okay, fuck the Israelis. We're killing everybody. We're killing America, too, because America done made this peace deal with the Egyptians, and we still don't have a Palestinian state. All bets are off. Let's go fight. So now you got this, you got this Islamic situation going on here, and we have the rise of Ronald Reagan, who played the game in the 1980 election in the background that kept our hostages in place so that he could use it against Jimmy Carter so that he could win an election. And you see also Ronald Reagan stoking anti-Islamic feelings and also building up the evangelical community in the United States. This is the first election in 1980 in which you see or hear talk about evangelical Christians and their connection with the Republican Party. Aha! Aha! You getting it? Are y'all starting to see the dots connected with the early 80s? So you have this rise in Islamic fervor that is politically motivated, of course. You know, you got political individuals who are using Islam as a focal point to get young men to go fight and kill themselves to drive the Jews into the ocean. And then you have the rise of the American evangelical community in Republican politics. One of the key points of the evangelicals here in America is that this belief in the rapture and their fascination with the Book of Revelation. This is when the Bible pops back into the game. Because in the Book of Revelation, one of the things that has to take place before Jesus returns is the rebuilding of the temple. The rebuilding of the temple can't take place unless the Jews control Jerusalem. And for the Jews to be able to control Jerusalem, there has to be a powerful Israeli state. And the Republicans in the United States, since the early 70s, have been trying to get every group it can to back them after they lost black people. Because if you didn't know that if you did vote in America in the 60s and you were black, you probably voted Republican up until LBJ. And then that comes into the whole Southern strategy of the Republican Party. You had to do something because you no longer had your base anymore. The Democrats controlled the nation. Because we had House and Senate majorities out in Virginia. But to counter the African American vote, the Republicans had to find new people to back them. So they chose Southern whites. They stoked up racism, and they stoked up religious fervor among Southern whites. Y'all see all these things connected? And a lot of Southern whites consider themselves to be evangelical. From Texas to South Carolina. And they all want to see Jesus come back. Because this world is getting out of hand. Jesus needs to come back now because the world is getting out of hand, because the white man, who is a very good Christian, is losing his hand and his foothold on everything. Jesus needs to come back right now. Right now, Jesus needs to come back. So how do you, as the Republican Party, get these people on your side? One, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that you, as a white person in America, do not lose your standing in this country. Republican economic policy, you know, that the trickle-down economics, you know, don't work. And making sure that wealth is concentrated in the hands of the right people, the right people who are white people in their idea, in their mindset. And we're going to help Jesus come back. And how we're going to do that is we're going to help the Israelis maintain and gain control over that area so that they can retake the city of Jerusalem. And once Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, undisputed, we can help them rebuild the temple. Do you not realize that there are collections taken up in evangelical churches around this country that are put in back, that are sending escrow to help rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, because they believe that once that temple is rebuilt, Jesus is going to come back and the second coming is going to come and everything is going to be all right again, just because they are scared that they are losing control and white supremacy is shrinking. Now, we've had liberal governments in Israel that have attempted to negotiate with the Palestinians, and this is why we have a Palestinian Authority today, because those liberal moderate governments. But in today's Israel, you have Benjamin Netanyahu, party is a right-wing party, very nationalist, has taken control of the state of Israel. And they are using the same tactics that we've seen in apartheid society for ages. They're doing the same thing the South Africans did. They're doing the same thing. Well, let's put this back. They're not even starting with South Africa. They're doing the same thing that white America has done, which the Germans and the South Africans picked up from us in this country. They picked it up from our government, okay? And now the Israelis are using the same tactic. Now, does this mean that the Israelis are the bad guys and the Palestinians are the bad guys? Are they the good guys? No. Because the thing is, you move that shoe, you move the pendulum into the other direction. They are just as quick to want to kill off the Israelis as the Israelis are wanting to kill. Right now, it's just the Israelis are in the power position. They have the weaponry, they have the numbers, they have the money, and they have the resolve to just bomb the other group into dust. And it's sickening. Because not just 60 years ago, longer than 60 years ago now, 70, almost 80 years now ago now, The same thing was taking place to Jews across Europe. The same thing has been happening to Jews in the United States forever, because Jews hung in trees as strange fruit, just like black folks. And there's always been a very interesting dynamic between the Jewish community and the African-American community up until this point, because some people in the Jewish community support of the nation of Israel and the state of Israel and its treatment of Palestinians. And a lot of black people have started to see themselves in the light of the solidarity with the Palestinians, because the Palestinians are an oppressed people. Because right now, they're catching hell. We used to see ourselves in the same light with the Jews because of the same thing. But now you are instituting the same amount of violence that has been put upon you for thousands of years. You're now doing it to someone else. And again, it's understandable because, as I said before, the main strategic goal of the state of Israel is to make sure that they're never in a position again for somebody to commit genocide against them. So when you put it into that context, this situation is a big shit sandwich. Because you got a group of people who have a very close in time, a very recent cultural memory of being hunted down and killed. There are still Holocaust survivors alive. There are still people alive who were children of Holocaust survivors. This was taught, and we as African Americans understand that there is a trauma and how trauma affects you as a people. Now, see, the difference between the Jews and African Americans is that the Jews have a homeland that, again, in recent memory, people have been attempting to wipe them out. They now have an upper hand. And so with that being the case, they are fervent about making sure that that doesn't happen again. How do we stop that? We stop it by stop fueling it. One, evangelicals. The Bible clearly states that the return of Jesus is on God's time. It ain't nothing you can do to trigger that. That is in the frame of white supremacy. And I ain't never seen it say, y'all think y'all gonna make God do something. Y'all think y'all gonna make, white is so powerful that y'all think y'all can make God do something. The Bible clearly states that we will not know the time nor place. And there ain't nothing we can do because we read through scriptures and we trigger this. Woo, Jesus. And then if Jesus does come back and you're able to trigger that, did y'all not read Red Letters? The Red Letters Jesus? Y'all in trouble because y'all have not taken care of the least of them. Y'all screwed over everybody on the planet. You've not loved your neighbor. You've not done anything. I do not think white supremacy wants Jesus coming back. Because if Jesus comes back, I don't think he's going to be y'all's friend. But we have to stop fueling this. Everybody has to stop sending weapons to these people. We have to stop sending funding to all sides. Dried up across the board. The Palestinians don't get none. The Jews don't get none. Nobody gets shit. Let them fight until they can't produce that. There needs to be boycotts and embargoes to collapse their freaking economy. Or bring them to the brink until they're ready to talk. Because neither side is innocent, because if the Palestinians get the upper hand, then they're going to try to kill the Israelis off. It's not worth them, because the moment they get a chance, they're going to start their path. It's a circle. There's a doomsday cult here in America that is based in white supremacy that is keeping this conflict going. Evangelicals spend billions of dollars a year supporting Israel, sending evangelical missions over there. The Israelis are not a developing nation. They don't need none of that. It's a very highly industrialized nation, capable of building its own weapon systems now, that was capable of building a nuclear weapons on its own. And we're sending people over there to do what? White people are going over there to do what? And then there's some people even in the African-American community who are part of this little doomsday cult who believe the book of Revelation is not... And you got this one thing about prophecy in the Bible. And I've studied the Bible for quite a while now. It is always a warning that if you continue to do X, Y, and Z, this is what's going to happen. And this doomsday cult has existed longer than it has been in America. There's been people in power who see it slipping, want Jesus to come back so the brown people don't take over. It's been like that forever. They thought Jesus was coming back when the Islamic conquest was taking place. They thought Jesus was coming back during the Great Awakening in America when black folks was talking about abolition, when we were talking about abolition. Every time there's enough people in the social strata in which you see white people who are prepared to lose control, they start talking about doomsday. And everybody who adheres to their form of Christianity goes into the same thing. Now, I am a Christian. I am a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ. I believe that he died on a cross and he rose in 3 days for the forgiveness of my sins. I also believe that Europeans, starting with the Catholic Church, manipulated the Bible for political reasons. I believe that King James of England wrote the King James Version of the Bible to suppress not only his fellow Englishmen, but suppress anybody that was of an underclass. I believe that there are books of the Bible that was left out that says there's another option. There's a revelation according to St. Peter that is completely different and not as apocalyptic as the revelations according to St. John. But you have to study yourself. This is why I said do not lean upon your own understanding. If you want to understand the roots of these conflicts, go read the book of Revelation. It's there. Read the Holy Bible. Read the Christian Bible. You will understand why the foundations of why this conflict exists. And how white supremacy, again, is raising its ugly head in a situation because these people are scared that the world will not be white. And I'm not a racist. I'm not bigoted. I'm not prejudiced. I'm just calling it for what it is. I want to see a world in which we can all hold hands and sing kumbaya. I want to see a world in which we love our neighbor. I want to see a world in which we take care of the least of them, where every man, woman, and child can have enough to eat, have decent shelter, and have clothing. Will there ever be a society in which we are all equal? No, because that we are not. We have equal opportunity. I want to see a world where we have an equal opportunity to be our best person. But some people don't want to live a certain way. Certain people can't live a certain way without assistance. Certain people are going to accumulate wealth. It's according to how we treat our poor. The poor will always exist. There will always be people who have less money than others. It's all according to how we treat them. And when we come to that conclusion that we're going to treat and give everybody equal opportunity to be the best person that they can be without hindrance based on color, race, gender, sexual orientation, or the numerous other constructs that we have that separate people, and we start to see each other as one human race, these kind of things are going to continue to happen. I don't want to see the world come to an end. I want to see the world have a brand new beginning. Most of us do. I want to see heaven on earth. It is possible. But that means we have to love each other. And this conflict is about a lack of love for other human beings because a group of human beings want the world to come to an end because they see control slipping from their hands and they're willing to do anything necessary to keep the world in conflict because they can make money off it. Well, we got less than a minute left in the show because this is a 90-minute show today. And for those of you who stopped in and listened, I appreciate you. Thank you. Next week, I'm going to be doing a book review. Kind of down along the same lines as some of what we're talking about today. I've been given a wonderful book titled How the South Won the Civil War. And I'm reading the book. And next week, I want to discuss what this book is talking about, what's the premise of this book, and how it is a true statement. We're going to talk about this next time on Down South and Dirty. This is Scott Smith, and this is Down South and Dirty, and we're out. Peace. Thank you.